You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
To Oslo now, where the no doubt horrified but calm people of Norway are observing the testimony in its second day of his trial of Anders Behring Breivik, the man accused of killing 77 people in bomb and gun attacks last July. He's been defending his actions in a statement to a court that has not been broadcast but is being widely covered. Lars Bevanger joins us from outside the courthouse. He's a reporter for our partner, the BBC. What can you tell us, Lars?
Well, Breivik took the stand today and read a prepared speech, which he had been allowed by the judge to present. It's highly unusual to read anything out loud in a Norwegian court. You usually give oral testament. But he was allocated 30 minutes to explain his ideological standpoint, which he says is crucial to understand what he did on the 22nd of July last year. And it was basically a very, very far-right, radical view of society and the world, where he says that Norway is today a Marxist dictatorship, and he is under siege, more or less, and he feels he's at war, and that what he did at Utøya and with the bomb here in Oslo was an act of war which was justified in his view.
And he's really saying that it's self-defense to kill 77 people in response to government policies of multiculturalism?
That's what he says. He even went further today and he said he did what he did not out of evil but out of good. He said he did it to prevent a wider, more damaging civil war in the future. He says that if nobody does anything, multiculturalism and Islam is going to overrun the Western world, and we will have something akin to the Crusades and the clash of civilizations in not too many years. It's all very hard to take in, and of course for the victims and the families of victims who are here in the courtroom listening to all this, is very, very hard to listen to him propagate his far-right views when what's really on trial here is his violent acts.
I have to say I have admiration for the Norwegian people, who are very, very solidly in favor of him having his right to speak, whatever he did. And as you say, this statement, very unusual in a Norwegian court. What are Norwegians saying about his sanity?
Well, most people here do believe he is sane, and they want this trial precisely to prove that he is, that he can explain exactly how he did it and what he did and why he did it, and that this could not be the action of someone who was not sane.
Lars Bevanger joining us from outside the courthouse in Oslo, Norway, on the Anders Breivik trial. He's a reporter for the BBC.
It really started with Jack Klugman and the show he starred in the 1970s and 80s. It was called Quincy M.E. Thus began the TV viewer's love for forensic science. And today, CSI is the most watched drama series in the world.
I found a small amount of this clear gel. It's similar to what I found in the boot print on the tarp. Gravitational drops here and here could be relevant, or might have just been under there well before it happened.
Forensic science is featured heavily in many of the most popular shows on TV in recent years. Dexter, Monk, Law & Order, Cold Case, Bones, that's a short list. But real crime scene investigations are rarely simple, and often the practice of forensics is not, if you'll excuse the pun, an exact science. Frontline, along with ProPublica, did an in-depth look at this issue and revealed their findings in a new documentary, The Real CSI. Frontline is produced by our partner WGBH, and the new documentary airs tonight on your local PBS station. Joining us now, the producer of the film, Andres Cedillo, and also on the line with us, Jennifer Mnookin, law professor at UCLA School of Law with a specialty in the field of evidence, and she's featured in the documentary. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Thank you
so much.
Andres, the beginning of your documentary actually examines the case of Brandon Mayfield. He was arrested in connection with the Madrid train bombings in 2004. A lot of the evidence against him was based on a partial fingerprint that turned out after 2 weeks of detention was wrong. So what does this case tell us, Anders, that we're relying too much on fingerprint evidence, or that fingerprint evidence isn't necessarily conclusive?
Well, I think what the Brandon Mayfield case tells us is that for all these years that we had been presuming that fingerprint evidence was infallible, as the FBI had been proclaiming, is just not true. We have this belief that when the examiner says it's a match, But what we realized when we started looking into it is there's no objective basis for being able to say this fingerprint comes from this person. You really just have two examiners looking at it and says, basically, it looks the same to me. They compare some points, and they come up with a standard of their own. There's no set standard by which to compare. And when they think it matches, it matches. In the Brandon Mayfield case, four different examiners all agreed it was him, and they were all wrong.
Let's talk about another case which is examined in the documentary. And this is about bite mark analysis. And I had understood, and obviously this may not be correct, that everyone's bite was individual as much so as, say, a fingerprint. But there was a case in 1990 from a little girl who was murdered in Mississippi in which bite mark analysis actually led investigators astray. Take a listen here.
They ran a dental impression on me. And then, like, a week later, my lawyer came to me and told me, said, we got a little bad news. I said, what you mean? Said the bite marks on the little girl match yours. I said, man, how can I bite somebody and I wouldn't even dare?
That's LaVon Brooks from Mississippi. He was actually sentenced to life in prison, largely based on that bite mark. Jennifer, what is problematic about bite mark analysis?
Oh, in my opinion, bite mark analysis is really unfortunate. To be honest, I don't think we should be using it as the basis for convicting anybody. It turns out that bite marks aren't individualizing based on what we know. Skin is so elastic that the same person biting different people can look more different than different people biting different people. So it's really disturbing the way bite mark forensic odontology has been accepted by courts and used as the basis for conviction when there really hasn't been science to verify or validate that it can show what it claims to show. It's really an unfortunate situation.
You know, Andres, I could understand people making the assumption based on watching too much of Bones or watching too much of CSI that this kind of science is very exacting. But do attorneys and judges think the same thing?
Well, we found, I mean, there are different standards by which the science is admitted into the courtroom. And so each judge, it's up to them when science is presented or when an expert is presented to decide whether they think it's valid or not as testimony. And what we found talking to lots of forensic scientists, lawyers, defense attorneys, prosecutors, is that for the most part, judges are willing to allow the science to come into the courtroom, let the lawyers argue about whether they think the science is valid or not, and have the jury decide. And it sounds great. I mean, that's how our court system works. But what a lot of people are now saying is that it shouldn't be up to the jury, who doesn't have the same background in all these forensic disciplines, to be deciding whether fingerprints is valid or not, whether bite mark analysis is valid or not, and that there should be some way of validating it beforehand, before it gets into the court.
Well, then that speaks to the experts that are coming in and speaking to it, right, Jennifer? I mean, how does one become an expert in forensic science and able to testify in, say, something as important as a murder trial?
Well, in a lot of these fields, it's in significant part an apprentice system. People learn by doing. They learn from other people who have been doing it for a long time. The other thing is, at least in federal court, we do have standards that are supposed to be governing the admissibility of expert evidence. We have a set of cases where judges are supposed to be gatekeepers, and they're supposed to make sure that the evidence that comes in is adequately valid. But when it comes to some kinds of forensic science, I think judges have been doing a poor job.
So Andres Cidio, the producer of The Real CSI, what do we take away from this, especially as we head into another very high-profile case with Trayvon Martin? We've already had experts talking quite a bit about voice analysis in the case of some of those 911 calls. Should we be concerned about the pursuit of justice in our court system based on what Jennifer's describing as faulty science?
The takeaway is that we need to scrutinize the forensic sciences more. We need to ask more questions. We need to not assume that everything is as valid as we might have assumed it was before. And just take these, start picking apart these disciplines and see what's the real science behind it, so that jurors are more informed. I think our law enforcement does a great job going out there collecting all this evidence, and there's a lot of value to the evidence. And we need to make sure that the evidence is being used correctly and that there's science behind it.
It's Andres Cedillo, producer of The Real CSI. It's a new Frontline documentary produced by our partner WGBH in partnership with ProPublica. The documentary airs tonight on your local PBS station. And we also spoke with Jennifer Mnookin, law professor at UCLA with a specialty in the field of evidence. She's featured in this documentary. So I guess the next step, Andres, is to watch tonight and have people get a little more educated at the real science you're talking about.
That'd be great.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And if you want to comment on that conversation or anything else on the program, visit us at thetakeaway.org or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us a story of how evidence failed you in your encounters with the criminal justice system. Don't send any fiber evidence to us. We don't really have the capacity to deal with that. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.